right, everyone, you're listening to another episode of the Something Beautiful podcast, episode 17, 1.17, for those of you keeping track. This week, hanging out right in front of the JFK Memorial in downtown Dallas on the steps of the Old Red Courthouse, looking across the grassy area here in the memorial setup. And Thomas, you're back there in Scotland, hanging out at home, watching some Heroes, as I understand.
Yeah, we were watching the new season of Bones has started, so Owen and I were watching the first episode of that, and it's set in merry old London, and there's so many stereotypes on display, it's unbelievable, you know, but good fun nonetheless. So unfortunately it's dark here. The weather's been quite nice, but it's dark, it's getting kind of late, kids are getting off to bed, and I have the pleasure of getting up tomorrow to Owen and the kids being off work and school. So I will have to get up and make zero noise and get myself off to work, because they will be lying in because they get a day off and I don't. So, as you can imagine, I'm kind of grumpy about that.
Well, I understand. So you said you've got to dress up tomorrow?
No dressing. I've got to get myself up. I've got to get myself to the station, because unless it's a gale force storm out tomorrow, there is no way I'm getting Owen up to get me to the station. So yeah,
gotcha.
It's all good. So.
And the sunlight in the windows is so solemn. At least that's what I thought. I'd curl your smoke around my little fingers and laugh that joke that I don't.
So this week on the podcast, we finish up our interview with Greg Garrett. Of course, Greg is a professor of English at Baylor University in Texas and the author of the book Stories from the Edge, A Theology of Grief. And we'll pick up right after kind of where we left off last week. And if you missed that interview, be sure to check it out on the website, somethingbeautifulpodcast.com, and listen to that. And we'll pick up right where we left off last week, right here on the Something Beautiful podcast. Now here's Greg Garrett.
Well, I will confess to you that most of the stories that I tell in this book are stories that I think mm-hmm. don't work. And I would guess that if you were to take a look, I don't know, maybe there are 12 or 15 different stories, sort of meta-narratives or controlling narratives that I talk about. And the whole idea behind the book really was to get them out in front of people so that they could recognize them in their own lives. And again, if people are finding meaning in this, then I'm not here to convert somebody. Mm-hmm. But I think some of these stories really are pretty toxic. The idea, for example, that some Christians have, that if you're being punished, that it's because you've done something wrong, I think is a really toxic idea of God and of relationship with God. And in the same way, when you think about some of the secular stories, however satisfied you might be with your iPod and your high-definition TV, I think you're really ignoring the important things that are supposed to be happening in existence if that's where your happiness is coming from. So when we think about some of those secular stories as well, the stories of consumerism, of technology and progress, of power, I think that those are spiritual dead ends.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely come out against the secular stories, and then I think even with some of the sacred stories. You know, as I said, my grandma has this particular set of beliefs that is working for her, and no one could talk her out of her beliefs at this point. So, you know, it gets her through the day, and she's living a life that's meaningful for her. And so, you know, it's not for me to step in and say, but grandma, you could do better.
Now, you just briefly touched on this, the iPhones, the iTouches, the high-def televisions and stuff are very identifiable with the Western culture that we live in and the American culture. These boxes and these views of God and suffering and so forth, do you think that they're simply an American idea, or have you seen them or experienced them through other cultures or heard stories through other cultures where they're identified the same ways?
Well, I would tell you that I wrote this book as a white, educated, middle-classed up or middle-class American. And I can tell you that other cultures, even in this country, don't do grief the same way that white, middle-class Americans do. Hispanic families, African-American families, they grieved very differently. Many of the white families that I was with were exactly like my family. They were destroyed, but you didn't see it. You know, it would be bad form to weep, to express your pain. And so, like people in my family, they swallow it, you know, and they'll get ulcers and have cancer, and then someone else, a generation down the road, will come in and not grieve openly. I've also traveled quite a bit, and I spent a lot of time in Africa, which I found to be a really refreshing culture in the way that they deal with grief. Part of our problem, I think, in America is that we are way, way too individual in almost everything we do. And when I was talking earlier about this radical idea that I came back to about the power of ecclesia, the local community, what I saw in Africa over and over again was this emphasis on family and on community. And one of my friends there, who I'd visited a couple of times, had a child, a small child who was killed when his hut burned down. And I thought, oh, my God, this is the most horrible thing I've ever heard. I mean, they lost everything. He and his wife just got out alive. The roof collapsed on their baby. And I asked him how he was getting through it. And he said, everyone is here for me. And I could see that. I mean, it was clear that in a way that we really don't do grief in our culture, that people were present for him. And I think there was something amazing to be learned from that, which, you know, I really had not made the connection until recently, this idea that what church is supposed to be doing is, you know, not just to be worshiping and enjoying and spreading the word of God, but also to be there for people who are in suffering. It's the Revised Common Lectionary this year, the gospel is Matthew, and I love all the gospels for different reasons, but what I love about Matthew is that what we find in it over and over again is that belief is not enough. Jesus tells us at one point that there will be plenty of people in the judgment who will be saying, Lord, Lord. But if they didn't follow his teachings, and in fact the Great Commission, which I got sort of in a garbled version in the church that I grew up in, is to go out in the world and teach everybody what I've taught you. And so there's this very powerful idea about doing as opposed to simply being or worshiping, which is, I think, at the heart of what I find compelling about Christianity now.
I remember, you know, I was in Nigeria for 2 weeks, and there were several deaths that happened just within the community kind of that I was a part of while I was there. And not, I mean, it was kind of a broad, broad community of missionaries and people working with the missionaries and stuff. But, of course, with AIDS and other issues, people. And it was a very communal type of way of dealing with it from what I saw. And it was almost, you know, the people were very willing to be to show that they're weak. They're very, very willing to show that, hey, I can't do this on my own. And the community was there to support them. I mean, there was a huge gathering of people that, you know, would come around these people. And yet I think in American culture, as you kind of touched on, we have the idea that we shouldn't be weak, that we shouldn't appear to be weak, that if we're struggling with something, if we're dealing with something, then we withdraw and we, you know, go into our room or into our closet, and then we can weep and we feel okay, or we think we feel okay. We want to shun everybody away from that. And it's almost this opposite of the idea that you touched on in the book, this weakness theology, that somehow we get this whole concept that being weak is completely opposite of what Christ is about and what Christianity is about.
Yeah, and what our example I mean, the clearest vision of what God wants, we understand through the life of Jesus. And here is somebody who said, I'm going to choose weakness, and I'm going to choose suffering. And a lot of theologians, of course, would say that this is a solidarity sort of thing, that for God to truly understand what the human experience is like, Jesus undergoes these things. And I don't know how I feel about that, but my own sense is that when we look at the life of Jesus, we see somebody who over and over again is rejecting power,
mm-hmm.
especially the power that people are wanting to thrust onto him. They want him to be the Messiah. They want him to be the Messiah they think he's supposed to be. And what he keeps telling them is that I've come to be a very different kind of Messiah. And I think he would be in real trouble if he came back now. I think that we would still be pressing him to be a very different kind of Messiah.
Mm-hmm. I find in my own self, in my own life, been married for, I guess, about a year and a half now. And one of the things that one of the things that I struggle with, and my wife and I have talked about this somewhat, is the idea that I need her, and that I need her in my life. And we're both very independent people, and it's hard for me sometimes to admit that I need someone else because I don't want to appear weak. I don't want to appear like I can't handle this on my own. And so I think we have a tendency a lot of times, just as people, to say, "Well, I don't want to be a burden on you, and I'm going to push through this on my own, and I'm going to avoid dealing with it," from what I'm trying to lay my burden on someone else. And that seems just opposite of what Christ may have done or what he may have encouraged.
Yeah. I think one of the things that your listeners might get from this, if they don't get anything else, is just the idea that Christianity is always culturally conditioned,
mm-hmm.
and they have absorbed a whole lot of really powerful American ideas, whether they want them or not. And one of those is that idea of individualism, of rugged individualism. I think it comes out when we talk about, you know, Jesus is my own personal mm-hmm. Lord and Savior. Because the sense that I get sometimes when people say that is like, all right, I've got mine, and I'm going to try and help some other people get theirs. But, you know, I'm taken care of, and that's, you know, that's good. So one of the things that I wanted to mention about Africa, by the way, is that some other cultural differences there is that, of course, they face death a whole lot more often than we do, and they face mm-hmm. it in different ways. We tend to sort of segregate death and suffering from us because it may be contagious. it has the stink of failure about it. But in Africa, you know, they don't have the same kind of institutional resources that we have, or at least people who are not living in the cities and well off. So, you know, when death happens, it happens in the community, and people are there, and they're present for it. And what I discovered in the hospital was that the best deaths, and notice what a countercultural sort of phrase that is, the best deaths that I saw in the hospital were people who were surrounded by the people they loved, and by people who embraced that this is really happening, and we're going to be a part of this transition. And I tell the story in the book, but one of the most powerful things that I witnessed all summer long was, because I'm Episcopalian, I carry around the Book of Common Prayer. And I opened it, I think, twice during the summer. Once when I baptized a couple of babies who had been born dead. And then a second time, I remember doing this service for the dying. And I was in a room with about 30 or 40 Hispanic family members, and they were Catholic, and they wanted something liturgical and beautiful, and they knew that their loved one was dying, and they wanted to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so cool, and it was so much better than many of the deaths that I saw where people, you know, waited in the waiting room or didn't want to really know about it and wanted to be kept separate from it as much as they could. And one of the conclusions I came to for myself was that I would rather not die in a hospital, but if I do die in a hospital, I want people that I love to be there with me. And not to, you know, to deny what's happening, but to say, okay, here it is, and let's mm-hmm. walk with you. There's I don't know if you're familiar with Anne Lamott.
Just briefly, yeah.
But she's one of my very favorite writers. I quote her a couple of times in this book. And in her book called Traveling Mercies, which is her first book of spiritual autobiography, she tells the story about being with one of her best friends, her childhood friend, as her friend's mom is dying, and how the two of them hold her and talk to her, and they whisper to her that it's okay for her to go and that God is with her here, and soon God will be with her there. And I've always thought that that's the most beautiful death, you know, surrounded by people you love and accepting that God is going to be with you through the process. And that's really sort of what I've come to through this. I don't want to die anytime soon, but I don't feel afraid of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you were talking about the best deaths, as you mentioned, that's kind of countercultural. You talked about one of those stories, and you kind of touched on it, about your favorite deaths of that summer. I mean, that does sound, that sounds almost morbid to us as Americans, but as you wrote, unexpected, but it's inevitable. And it is our approach to death in the stories we tell about death that we find much about life itself. You look at Ecclesiastes, and you know, Solomon writes, it's better to be in the house of mourning than the house of birth, just because we really realize so much about our own self and about life and such. One of the things that I continue to think as I'm reading your story and reading the book was, I think about what Brian McLaren writes about in Everything Must Change, and I think he's talking maybe on a broader scale, but he talks about the framing stories that we put ourselves in, that we've kind of framed our life on a particular story, on a particular idea, particular box, as you might say. And then all of a sudden, as you mentioned, catastrophic events happen, and all of a sudden we realize that that frame is the worst frame we might want to put ourselves in. Would you agree with that? Would you say that's kind of the same idea?
Yeah, I love the way that Brian has used this idea of controlling narratives in the work that he's done. And I know that there are a lot of people who are either afraid of Brian or angry at him. But I think that in the same sort of way that, you know, I'm not saying that I'm here to profess a Christianity that will change your Christianity if your Christianity is good for you. I think that Brian is saying, you know, there are a lot of people who have not found God in the stories that we are telling. And if we could find some other ways to tell them that would still be powerful and relevant and true to God, then that would be ideal. I said in the introduction, I think one discussion that Brian and I have that's ongoing is about the difference between modernism and postmodernism. Mm-hmm. And, of course, postmodernism is a worldview which suggests that all controlling narratives fall apart. And I think if you take it that far, you're actually getting to the point where you're actually just sort of, I don't know, smorgasbording your own religion. I think that there must be some controlling narratives that do hold. And my experience so far has been that my controlling narrative about God and the church is doing just fine. You know, it's holding up against the grief and suffering that's been meandering into my life over the last 5 years. And so I know that actually what Barbara Brown Taylor would say is that I just found a more expansive box. And, you know, something could happen to make me realize that I need to break that box open as well. But that whole idea of examining our stories and opening the way for some new stories, I think, is a really valuable thing that he's done. So I'm certainly on board for almost everything.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's plenty more questions I could ask, and, you know, would love to spend hours just sitting and talking with you about your stories. And I hope that in the story of the book and to listen to these things. But one last question about the book that I wanted to ask was, you touch on the difference between the Hebrew understanding of suffering, the Old Testament understanding of suffering, and the New Testament or the Christian understanding. How would you compare those two, and how do those two differ?
Well, when we look at the Hebrew Lamentations, and that's Psalms, it's the Book of Lamentations, and we can throw Job in there as a sort of discussion of grief and suffering as well. The Hebrew idea that we see up until really the development of Second Temple Judaism is a very sort of temporal and physical idea that if redemption is going to come, it's going to be in this life. It's not until we get to some of the apocryphal books like Maccabees that the idea of the righteous martyr comes along, the idea that is a very powerful part of the Christian idea that justification may not come in this life, but it will come. And that's sort of at the heart of what we believe in terms of Christianity, the idea that what happens on this earth is valuable, but good and bad may not be repaid in a physical way on this earth, but that our faith will be confirmed in the resurrection. And so there are, I think, valuable things about both of those ideas. Mm-hmm. What I found really valuable about those psalms, especially the darker psalms, was the ongoing idea of relationship. And there's a really powerful thread in Jewish thought. I talked also about some of the Holocaust writings and the idea that even when God doesn't seem to be there, there is this powerful belief that he is there nonetheless. I talk about David, you know, who prayed for his son to be saved, and when his son died, he said, okay, now I'm going to get up and get cleaned up, and I'm going to go worship. And the same sort of thing that Elie Wiesel wrote about in Auschwitz, where a group of rabbis put God on trial for neglect and found him guilty and then went and celebrated Shabbat. I think that there is an incredibly powerful message there for Christians and Jews alike about faith and the necessity of keeping faith even when it doesn't seem like things are working out for us. So that, I think, is something really powerful, worth keeping. And then in the Christian tradition, there's just this very powerful idea that also helps us that maybe things are not going to be worked out in this life. Maybe, you know, I've said the prayer of Jabez every day for the last 5 years, and I'm not going to get what I want. Or maybe I've given all this money to a TV evangelist, and I'm not going to be rich. I am, when the judgment comes, however you think about that, whether you know, see a heaven with streets of gold, or you see a new heaven and a new earth, that God will recognize our faithfulness, if not now, when that time comes. And that, again, is a story that allows us to make sense of suffering. You know, I've been faithful to God. I've tried to do everything that God wanted me to do, and my life just sucks. But it won't always. You know, that day will come, and you know, however you think about the afterlife, God will recognize my faithfulness.
I guess finally, the question probably everybody's wanting to know, or probably would want to have answered, is in the wake of tragedy, whether it be something catastrophic like 9/11 or Hurricane Ike or Hurricane Katrina or any of those things, or maybe just in the midst of personal tragedy, such as a loss of a loved one, how would you help them to, what would you say to that person that's suffering that loss? How would you help them to get through that and move forward?
Well, there are a couple of things that I would try and do from a pastoral standpoint. One that would be very important would be to reinforce the idea that God is present. And I would try and pull the scriptural resources together to share with that person how, from our understanding of the Hebrew Testament and the Christian Testament, that God is present, that God is a God of love, that God cares for us as his creations, and that even when sadness and difficulty come into our lives, it doesn't mean that we're cut off from God, that God is there and available. I mean, that would be a big thing that I would want to share with people. A second thing is, if you're a person suffering, I would encourage you to look for a community that will let you suffer with them. That, for me, was the most powerful thing, to recognize that I wasn't alone, because I certainly felt alone. And our culture, as we said, doesn't really do a good job of not making you feel alone when you're suffering, because everybody else seems to be going on with their lives. The funny thing about that is, I wrote in Crossing Myself that I think we live in a world full of broken people who think that they are the only broken person. And once we open ourselves up to the awareness that there are a lot of other people around their suffering, it becomes possible for us to create this solidarity. I think one of the most powerful things that grew out of 9/11 was this powerful sense that people were suffering together. It was, in some ways, very unusual for American culture to do this, but it was not just in New York and Washington. It was something that we all shared, and in fact, people around the world shared. I do a lot of traveling overseas, and I was talking to Germans this summer and people in England and Scotland in the spring about how they shared that suffering with us because they had all witnessed it. So, you know, the idea that God is present, the idea that people are there, and this, for many people, is their crisis of faith.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be. It's usually the crisis of faith for people because they've come to the absolute limit of what their stories will bear. And so, you know, I put in my money and God didn't give me back a Coke. And now I'm just standing here shaking the machine and then I'm afraid it's going to fall over and crush me or something. And I think I'm going to leave and just, you know, I'm going to forget about my money and I'm just going to walk out. I'm never going to drink another Coke. And I think, you know, crisis is a horrible time to start readjusting your worldview.
Right.
But sometimes that's the only way we do it. Change often comes to us in very difficult ways. And if we could be open to the possibility of change, to recognizing, you know, maybe I didn't get it right. Maybe there's a better way for me to be thinking and believing. If we could open ourselves to that, that'd be powerful as well. And I guess one last thing, which is sort of the conclusion I come to in the book, not to give away the ending, but, you know, it's not like it's going to be a surprise ending to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The lesson that I came to in my own life and from my reading of the scriptures and of theologians is that everything that we are given in this life is just that. It's a gift. And grief often comes from our inability to deal with change and loss and to recognize the things that we have as a gift and that many times gifts are not permanent. I talked about one of the good deaths that I experienced, an African-American family. The father had a heart attack on Father's Day, which you would think would be a pretty horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he had lived 6 years longer than his family expected him to because he'd received a heart transplant. And he was the first person that I saw die. He was the first, his family was the first that I sat with at the deathbed. And I just marveled at how well they were handling things. And the whole idea was that they were so grateful that they had had those 6 years. You know, every day that he woke up was a gift for them. And if we could start seeing things in our life in that way, that I think is, for me, sort of the theological and practical thing that could be a really important thing for your listeners to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're human, we love the things that we have and we want to have them forever. But we live in a world where things change, where things grow sick, where things die. And that doesn't make it any easier. But, you know, I look at some of the relationships that I've had in my life that have died. I look at people that I've had in my life who have died. I look at things that I've had that are gone. And if I can be thankful that I ever had them, it really changes my attitude toward them in a monumental
yeah.
way.
Yeah, very good. Well, Greg, definitely enjoyed the book as someone who's suffered a loss of someone close to me. It definitely spoke to me. Excuse me. And I thought that it was just a great book to kind of put into words some of the things, you know, those ideas, those boxes that we wrap around ourselves and those misconceptions. And I would say that other than C.S. Lewis's book, A Grief Observed, I think this was probably one of the best books that I've read that really helped me deal with some of the loss of my own personal self. And
well,
so definitely appreciate the book.
Great company. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. It was a joy to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And all good wishes and God's blessings to all those listening.
Well, we appreciate it. And if people want to find out more about you or follow you along on the web, you are working on a new translation of the Bible with Brian McLaren and Jim Wallace and Lauren Winter. Or is it Weiner?
Winner.
Okay, I was wondering.
Don't let her hear you say that.
Wasn't sure which pronunciation was correct.
Yeah, it is Lauren.
So you're working on that, and I'm assuming you'll kind of update people on your blog, theotherjesus.com, as those things progress.
I will. It's what I do on the blog is kind of interesting. I don't do sort of everyday life kind of things as some bloggers do.
Mm-hmm.
But what I try and do is I write something substantial every week or 10 days. That's sort of reflecting what I'm thinking about and working on. And It's a way for people to sort of see what I'm doing and what I'm thinking. But I do try and keep up in the about the author section about what's coming out and where I'm going. I do a lot of speaking and teaching kinds of things. And I hope if I'm in your neck of the woods that those of you listening would come out and say hi.
Definitely. Well, Greg, we appreciate your time. And I'm sure our listeners are going to enjoy hearing your story and also picking up the book, Stories from the Edge, A Grief Observed. And they can find that on Amazon or at probably most any bookstores in their area.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
All right, thank you, Greg.
The sun rose early, climbed into the sky, took away the cold night air, brought the warm dawn light, and Jesus sat upon a rock, looked around at the gathering throng.
Jonathan, second part of Greg's talk.
Yes.
Totally inspirational. The guy is a really genius guy, and you know, he's that part of the interview. You know, I mean, very, very strong. And I think some of the points he's talking about, you know, I think sometimes when you hear it from coming from people like that, you don't actually appreciate. You know, until you see get somebody else's perspective on things, how you can fully appreciate that, you know, and what he's talking about, you know, going into detail about suffering, and you know, and he's talking about the whole of our sort of Western, you know, and he does go into give a bit of sort of white American, but you could probably expand it a bit. But that whole expression of the pain is just way too individualistic. You know, this whole individualism that has invaded what I would argue is evangelical circles. This whole, you know, personal Lord and Savior is very much an individual thing. And we have lost that sense of, you know, the power of the local community and the local family. And when he talks about that, he makes that point about the I believe it was an African that spoke about how that everyone is here for me, and how in that point of suffering, in that point of death, that everyone was there for that individual. You know, see, I even talk about him as an individual. You know, that person was there, being surrounded by everyone that mattered to him, and it just was a really, really powerful metaphor. And I think, you know, I think we have become too individualistic, and I think that was a real eye-opener. It was a real sort of it was a real, you know, wake-up call as to in a sense to how we deal with pain and how we deal with these issues in individual times. And you know, I'm kind of struggling with one of my friends is going through a really bad time at the moment. She's ill and in hospital. And the one thing I'm determined to do is to ensure that she doesn't suffer alone, that she knows that there are people there for her. And that is a real, you know, that's really hard because, you know, she's miles away. And you know, gas prices as they are, it would cost a lot of money to get there. But we've managed to get people. You know, one of my pals was there, spending time with her today. And you know, it's about that. It's just realizing that look, you don't suffer alone. That there are people there. That you know, we need to all support each other. That as Greg speaks about the fact that the church needs to be there for people. The church isn't just about coming together for worship. It isn't just about coming together to pray or to come together to do some work in the community. It's coming together to be there for people in whatever that means. And I'm trying desperately to live that out. I'm trying desperately to actually put that into practice at the moment with my friend who is ill. It really came home to me when I was listening to this. It really, you know, Greg's sort of perspective on things has really, really helped me with how I approach my friend and her sort of her illness and how we work, you know, work together with her, and how I can in some way support her, and how I can sort of tell her, look, you're not alone. You know, there are people out there that love you dearly and are there for you, and you know, and I just mm-hmm. found that really, really powerful. I don't know about you. How did you find it? Obviously you've gone through a loss recently, or it seems recently, but you've gone through mm-hmm. personal loss. How did you feel with regards to, you know, when he's talking about that need to be together with other people?
Yeah, I think that's it's one of those things you don't really understand until you're right in the middle of it. And I think that having those people there means the world. And, you know, after my sister passed away, it's been over 3 years now. It seems like yesterday, but it's been 3 years, and it's just, you know, one of those things where the thing that got to help me get through it was just having people there that would listen and let me talk. And, you know, it wasn't somebody who necessarily got my ear off and told me, well, this is what you need to believe, this is what's happening, this is God's going to do this or God's going to do that, or, you know, blah, 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 blah. It was somebody that just said, hey, how are you doing? You know, and let me talk. And even when they didn't ask, they still let me talk, and they're willing to listen. I had a really good friend, Chris, that worked with me at the newspaper at the time, and he was, you know, we'd work a lot of late nights at the newspaper, and he was always glad to listen and always glad to talk. And, you know, he didn't try to give me some kind of amazing advice or try to give me some amazing scriptures that was going to somehow take away all my pain. He just was there.
Yeah.
And I had a number of friends that were like that were there. And let me talk through things. And that means a lot. And I had another friend who, roughly at the same time, we got to know each other, and she had lost someone very close to her. And she just said, you know, what got me through it was just people coming and just sitting in my living room with me. They didn't have to say anything. They didn't expect me to say anything. They just came and sat. And I knew that they were right there with me and suffering with me. And, you know, that's what I love about Greg's point, is that it's the people there that are suffering with us that makes a difference, but then also knowing that God suffers with us makes a huge difference as well, and that God's right there alongside of us. You know, and he made the point that we all suffer differently, we all grieve differently. As a white American, you know, he makes the point that, hey, my family has a tendency to internalize things, and I think that we do that as well, probably in our family to some extent, but there are other people that are really open about it, and they really, you know, expressive about it. And I think that that's a real healthy way to do it, and that's a real way of letting people know that, hey, I'm human, and I'm going to suffer, and I'm going to hurt. So just being there for people means so much.
Yeah.
Because we have a tendency, I talked to a friend today, and, you know, we have a tendency to withdraw and to kind of get into this self-pity type of living. And so we don't want anybody else to know that we're hurting or that we're grieving. But that just puts us deeper and deeper into the hole when we pull away from others and we don't admit that, hey, I'm struggling and I need some help with this.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, that we fear judgment. We fear, you know, we fear the, you know, disgusting people. We fear shame. We fear pity. We fear all these outcomes that we in some way envisage, and that, you know, admitting that we are broken, admitting that we're hurting, admitting that we suffer. And I think the thing is that we need to get away from that, you know, the power, you know, the British idea of the stiff upper lip, you know, that I rejected that a long time ago. You know what I mean? When something bad happens, I'll openly cry. You know, that there has been times when I've been known to wail like a banshee, I think the expression is. But it's good release. And mm-hmm. I think that's important. And when we look at the look at this, you know, I'm very blessed in such a way that, you know, I haven't lost anybody in my immediate family. My parents are still alive. You know, Alwyn and the kids are in perfect health. I've never come to that closeness of grief, and I've lost a couple of uncles recently. My uncle Robert died a couple of years ago, and a close family friend who was treated like an uncle died almost a year ago. And the thing about it was is that it's important to let it out. It's important to let it go. But it is also important to be there for those that are in the immediate family that are suffering. And I always remember about my uncle Robert. And, you know, I always look back and how rich he was. Now, my parents were comfortably middle class as a family. You know, we're not wealthy in these sort of material terms. You know what I mean? My mum and dad own their house and can go away for more holidays than, you know, most people. But, you know, we're comfortable. But the thing is I looked around at my uncle Robert, who was a self-employed printer at the time, and he had his son, he had his daughter, he had his wife there, he had so many friends that surrounded him and were in the hospital with him in the last days. And that just for me was just really, really powerful, that wealth isn't counted by what we have, but wealth is counted by who we have in our relationship. And when you talk, you know, when Greg talks about the beautiful death, you know, he talks about concepts of beautiful death surrounded by the people that you love, I automatically thought of my Uncle Robert. I automatically thought of that. And I think sometimes you wish that you could, the people that have died could see the funeral that they have. Being a member of the Salvation Army, when soldiers die, it tends to be a real celebration. Very much a case of we have this term called promoted to glory. This term that, you know, hey, you haven't died. This isn't, you know, it's about the next step. It's about, you know, the fact that you will be with, you know, that soldier will be with the Lord, and they will have received their well done, good and faithful servant. And, you know, our funerals tend to be joyous occasions. I remember going to one wedding where they sang, the choir sang Count Your Blessings.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but I haven't been to too many funeral services where Count Your Blessings was one of the songs that were sung. But yet, it just felt so right. You know, I've been at funerals where there's been clapping, and that just felt so right. And when you talk about, when Greg talks about this concept of the beautiful death, of being surrounded by people you love, it really makes sense. You know what I mean? You can see real true wealth in that sense about being surrounded by the people that you love. And I think it's important to do that, to be surrounded by the people, not just in the funeral. You know, not you, because obviously the individual can't see that, but be surrounded in those times. And you don't need to have answers. You just need to be there. And I think that's the same, the sense of when we have this relationship with the Lord, that we know that the Lord is there for us. And I love the quote that he talked about, when he talked about the story from the Second World War, about these rabbis that found God guilty of neglect and then went and celebrated Shabbat. You know what I mean? I just thought that was just such a beautiful thing. You know, that we have this relationship with God, that even when we don't hear him, even when he isn't here, we know that he is there for us. And that is so crazy to think. You know what I mean? There's so many people who just give up at that point. But that's true faith. That's not a faith that's based on intellect or belief. That's a real living acceptance. And that is a really, really beautiful thing.
Right.
So yeah, no, again, totally got where he was coming from with this. What did you think of his 3 points at the end? You know, I mean, for people that were helping, you know, for folk like, you know, for ourselves, if we're ever in that position where we have to help folk move forward when they are suffering in that way. You know, the 3 points to tell people that God is present, that God is love and cares for them, that, you know, to encourage people to look for a community that allows them to suffer with them, and then to see what we have as a gift. What was, did you have any thoughts with regards to that, certainly with your situation with Amy?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think that kind of goes right along with what I experienced, is that you have to realize that God is there suffering with you, and that other people are as well, and we have to be willing to do that. You know, we did an interview last week with a guy that we're going to have in a couple of weeks, but he made the point of how sometimes in community, people will start to feel welcome, and they'll start to open up, and they'll start to share what's really on their heart, or maybe even share a part of their past. And, you know, if you start giving them an odd look, like, oh my gosh, you know, I can't believe he's saying this, then all of a sudden they're going to shut down and be like, well, I guess this isn't a safe place for me. This isn't a place where I can really share.
Yeah.
And we need to try and, you know, when people are suffering or whenever people have suffered, we need to be sure that we're building spaces of grace, a space where grace is definitely abounding and that they can feel welcome and that they can feel like they can share. You know, because if even if it's a year or 2 or 3 years later, you know, after someone suffered, there's still stuff that they're going to be dealing with and there's still stuff that they're going to go through. And, you know, if they're in a group and they're in a group setting, they feel like all of a sudden they feel like they need to share something, and someone's like, really, you went through that 3 or 4 years ago. You know, why are you still bringing that up? Then, of course, they're going to feel like, well, I guess I'm a failure at this, and I don't need to share this. And so it's one of those things, we have to be sure that we're willing to listen to these people and that we're accepting of them and loving them and really showing them the care that they need, because everybody's going to grieve differently. Everybody's times are going to be different. And so those, just letting them know that not only is God there, but we're there. And then finally, my wife and I talked about this a little bit last night, just the idea that every day is a gift.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we just found out that my grandfather has bone cancer. Oh, and it's pretty serious. And it's, I mean, it's throughout his whole body. And so you don't really know how much time he has left. And you don't know, you know, there's chemo is probably out of the question. You know, other treatments are probably out of the question other than just taking away the pain. And so it's, you got to really look at it as, and this is something that Greg mentions in the book especially, is every day is a gift.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, whether he lives 5 years from now, 10 years from now, or a week, every day is a gift. And if we view things that way, then it tends to make the suffering a lot easier.
Yeah, definitely. I think from my own experience, you know, dealing with my Uncle Robert's death was such a shock because it was just so soon. And what was more of a shock was the fact that he had been told, you know, prior to it that he was all clear and we'd been so jubilant. And yet then he went through this, you know, really quite a short cancer-related illness and died. And I think the thing that, you know, he was able to suffer with his friends, and the people that journeyed with him up to that point surrounded him and kept him going, and his family pulled together, and, you know, my mother and my aunt and my uncle all really pulled together to support him, because he's the youngest of their family. And that really, you know, that whole idea of being with people that allow you to suffer was just, it made so much sense. It was one of these ideas that you think, wow, do you know, that makes sense. You know, why didn't I think of that? And then I look at my other uncle, I look at Bill, and think that he was diagnosed with the cancer that eventually killed him like 20-odd years ago. You know, I mean, I think he had about 18 years where he was living with his cancer. And for me, that's an amazing idea that, you know, here he was living for 18 years with the thing that finally got him. And you know, it's about that idea of living every, you know, that we have, a, the not taking stuff for granted, not, you know, to the looking, you know, I must be the slowest reader on the planet, but I've been reading, Frost and Hershey's book, The Shaping of Things to Come. And we're reading today, I'm sitting in Starbucks, the Starbucks concession in Borders, the big bookshop in Glasgow. And I'm reading about the hallowing of everything and every day and everything, you know, ordinary items that, you know, that we should be seeking to find God's glory in everything. And that really, you know, between that and, you know, listening to what Greg was talking about, I think it really shapes us differently. You know, if we get out of this whole dualistic split of the sacred and the profane and celebrate life in all its fullness, and then celebrate, you know, see that death is a celebration of life, and surround people in that celebration, I think that is very much, it's a holy, you know, it's a holy, there is holiness there. To surround, you know, to celebrate life and to find God's glory and to find God's glory in death as well, because He is there with us, you know. And I just think that between the reading that in the book today, when I was having my coffee at lunchtime, and then, you know, listening to Greg today, I think it's all kind of combines, and, you know, it comes back to this whole idea of the whole of life. It's the whole of me that, you know, I'm not giving God part of me. I'm giving God everything. And that includes my suffering. That includes the times when, you know, I feel distant and, you know, I'm so caught up with my own things, but I know that He's still there. And, yeah, that was really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good chat with Greg, and glad that we were able to talk with him, and be sure to pick up his book, The Stories from the Edge, A Theology of Grief. And you can find that on Amazon. We also have a couple links to that on our website as well. And we got a couple good interviews coming up the next few weeks, and looking forward to sharing those. And also want to be sure to say hi to Pete, to Jeff Pete, with the Born Again Christian podcast. He and his wife, NASA Janet, had a baby, I guess, on Wednesday evening.
Yeah.
Baby Ruby was born on Wednesday evening to Just Pete and NASA Janet. So congratulations to them. And from what I understand on Twitter, the baby and mother are doing well. And
yeah,
I guess Pete's doing well as well.
Yeah. Now, just, I think it's, you know, Twitter just always amazes me. I've had some really bad news over the last sort of week or so over Twitter, but I've had some amazing good news. And, you know, Just Pete announcing the birth of Ruby was a real highlight for me today. Just was really, really wonderful. We almost follow the tweets as NASA Janet went through contractions, etc. But one of the other big things was a couple of friends of ours are of mine from Memphis, a place that's nearer you than me, have, you know, got engaged. The my friend Matthew, aka the Space Base, proposed to Kerry, aka Skeleton Key, and I was able to kind of follow that through in the Twitters as well. So I think that's just really awesome. This, you know, I think almost every week I'm talking about Twitter in some way or other. But it was just really between the birth, you know, hearing about the birth of Ruby and, you know, hearing about Matthew and Kerry's engagement is just really awesome. So it's, you know, again, it comes back to that whole idea of being there for people in the good times as well as the bad. So, yeah, it's been a good week all in. So anyway, I better say goodbye. It's now after 11, and the kids are in bed and everything's in darkness. So just like to thank you, JD, for your time, and to thank you for the interview with Greg. It was a very good interview, very heartwarming, and just really challenging and just really inspirational. So thank you.
Appreciate it. Well, I'm going to head home and first find a bus, but find a bus, head home, and tonight is the Office season premiere, season 4. So we're having some friends over to watch that tonight. So looking forward to seeing what Steve Carell has for us tonight.
See, when you talk about The Office, you're talking about the American Office, whereas...
You know, of course.
We remember the Ricky Gervais Office, you know, the real one. Yeah, that's quite
right.
Funny.
Well, you probably missed the Emmys, the U.S. Emmys on Sunday night, but the guy that starred in the British version was actually giving Steve Carell a hard time about it, saying, you know, I made you, and, you know, you owe me everything because I made you, and you wouldn't have a career without me, and so forth. So it was quite amusing.
Yeah, Ricky Gervais is quite a funny guy when he gets in the mood, and if you're in the mood for him, because he can be a bit awkward at times, but he's a really, really funny guy. So with that, I'll leave you.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you next week on the Something Beautiful podcast, and I'm sure we'll be Twittering in between.
Yes, you will.
All right. Have a good one, Thomas.
Cheers.
Something Beautiful Podcast. Join us again next week at somethingbeautifulpodcast.com.